This is one of the earliest strikes in the first years of the first industrial revolution in America.
Shoemaking was one of the most lucrative trades in Philadelphia during the 18th and early 19th centuries. Shoemakers, known as cordwainers at the time, were among the first to organize into journeyman societies in the United States. In 1805, cordwainers went out on strike over wages and their changing workplace. Northampton Community College professor of history Patrick Grubbs chronicled the cordwainers' strike of 1805 and explained what came of it on America's Workforce Union podcast earlier this month.
When it came time to sign union cards, the symphony opposed the election, claiming the musicians were independent contractors.
On this week's Labor History in Two, Musicians Fight Back. And we wrap up this week's show with Barry Raben's song about a little-known 1982 strike.
Little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys. The gear, the elves went out on strike.
I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. I hope you enjoy the show. Shoemaking was one of the most lucrative trades in Philadelphia during the 18th and early 19th century. Shoemakers, known as cordwainers at the time, were among the first to organize into journeyman societies in the United States. These were the nation's first labor unions, and they were completely illegal and prosecuted as quote-unquote criminal combinations. This battle over whether workers have a fundamental right to organize and to withhold their labor continues to this day. In 1805, cordwainers went out on strike over wages and their changing workplace. The hiring of inexperienced, untrained, and cheap artisans had begun diminishing their work and the industry. Northampton Community College professor of history Patrick Grubbs chronicled the cordwainer strike of 1805 and explained what came of it on America's Workforce Union podcast earlier this month. Grubbs said that these artisans were one of the first instances of scab labor, or cheap non-union labor, hired for the purpose of increasing production without hiring more expensive skilled labor. Here's America's Workforce Union podcast host, Ed Flash Ferenc.
Let's go to line number one and welcome to the show. Newcomer to the show. His name is Patrick Grubbs. Patrick serves as the Associate Dean for Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and a professor of history at Northampton Community College, which is located in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Patrick, when I hear Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, I come from a steelworker family. I think of Bethlehem Steel, and I'm sure that's legendary in that community. What has replaced Bethlehem Steel in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania today, Patrick?
So parts of the structures still exist, but they've turned at least one part of the old Bethlehem Steel structures into a casino.
And really?
Yeah, this was something probably in the last 6-7 years, and there was actually talk, I'm not sure if they're still doing it, but there was actually talk of creating an outdoor water park also over the old area of Bethlehem Steel as well.
So instead of making money, they're taking your money. And that's what's happened all over America. We record this show out of Cleveland, Ohio, and we were steel town at one time, and we still have steel facilities here, don't get me wrong. But one of the big players was LTV Steel, and that area is now called Steel Yard Commons, and it's a shopping center. So that's the America that has changed over the years, and sadly, sadly, it's all those good manufacturing jobs that have disappeared. Today is going to be an interesting show because I was mentioning this at the top of the show about this cordwainer strike. I'm scratching my head. What the heck is the cordwainer? What is a cordwainer? So cordwainer is a shoemaker, and we're going back. My gosh, this is right after the American Revolution. We're talking, like, what was it, back in the late 1700s, they were gathering together, and then in 1805, they went on strike. Why don't you recap what happened then, and more importantly, how this relates to today? Go ahead, Patrick.
So the cordwainer strike of 1805 is a pretty straightforward, relatively simple strike. None of the like flash and pizzazz or violence that we see in the strikes of the later like 19th century. It's important to understand why they went on strike. And then it's also important to understand why this particular strike or situation went to trial. And so one of the things that we see is that this is one of the earliest strikes in the first years of the first Industrial Revolution in America. Mm-hmm. And so the strike itself was basically just about, it seems on the surface to be just about wages. But in actuality, it's about the changes that are happening within the workplace and the separation that's beginning to happen between these master artisans and these journeymen within the cordwainer industry. And so from the early 1790s, what we start to see is this separation of these master artisans into creating sort of a more market economy. They start to move away from what was referred to as a small producer economy. Mm-hmm. And now they're starting to produce for larger markets. And in the process of doing so, they start to change the entire sort of work customs of the industry. No longer are they starting to hire apprentices that would work within this system. They wouldn't bring on apprentices that they would promise room and board to. Essentially, they would just start to hire them as workers and pay them just monetary compensation. So this paternalistic system that existed before is starting to fade away. The master artisans are also starting to move away from the city. They used to have the first floor of their shop, or their house was their shop. And that's where the master artisans and the journeymen and the apprentices would all work together. Now they're starting to move outside the city, and they're starting to become more businessmen and merchants than they are master artisans. And so As all these changes are taking place, the journeymen are starting to experiencing these changes, and they look around and they see things like the increased presence of semi-skilled laborers and the increase in wage labor, less avenues for advancement. They see the increased division of labor. They see reduced wages. And they look around and they're just terrified at what's happening to labor within America.
Yeah.
And so in the 1790s, we start to see in Philadelphia, these cordwainers become some of the most active labor advocates in America at the time. In 1791, you had a moment where these two shoemakers try to come into Philadelphia and they set up shop and they try to undersell the current market. And the cordwainers, both master and journeyman at this point, they combine together to basically run these guys out of town. And then in 1794, the cordwainers, the journeyman cordwainers, form what was essentially one of the first journeyman societies in American history. And that's when they form this Federal Society of Journeymen Cordwainers in Philadelphia. And here, when the society started, it actually began as a mutual aid, a mutual benefit society for journeymen, as they're trying to protect their status and to protect themselves from the changes that are being implemented by these master artisans. And so from 1794 through 1799, we start to see the changes that I just talked about that are happening because of the first Industrial Revolution. They're starting to happen within the shoe industry itself. We see that increased division of labor, increased output of work, and then we're also starting to see this increased production for outside markets. And that's where the origins of this strike really lay. So in Philadelphia, in order to be more competitive, the master artisans, who are essentially now merchants, they start producing this export work. They start producing work for outside markets like in Charleston or in the West Indies. And in doing so, when that process first began, they actually gave their laborers, these journeymen, the opportunity to produce this work for like a third of the cost. But it was extra work. They could essentially make extra money if they produced this export work, but it wasn't part of the requirement, let's say, of their daily routine. Five, what happens is that this export work has now become part of their regular work, and it's starting to take up more of their time. And because of that, they're receiving less wages because that export work had been agreed to at a lower price. So in 1805, journeymen cordwainers come together, and they basically demand the increase in wages for this work, along with other custom boot work. And they used cordwainers in New York and Baltimore as an example to say that these are the wages that they're receiving. And so they asked the master artisans for the increase in wages. And when the masters declined, the journeymen went on strike, or essentially turned out, in the fall of 1805.
How long did the strike last?
So the strike lasts about 7 weeks. And as I said, it was a pretty straightforward, it was a simple strike. Not a lot of violence, basic marching or protesting outside, let's say, a cordwainer's shop, Wainer's shop. But as a result of the strike, the workers, after the 7 weeks, they actually went back to work at the reduced wages. And then the society then took a hit. There were about 40 members of the society that left. And the bigger consequence from this was the fact that master artisans, in particular, a gentleman by the name of John Bedford, who was one of the master shoemakers in Philadelphia, he brought charges, he brought this issue to court. And so then on November 1st, 1805, eight of the leading journeymen were indicted by a Philadelphia grand jury on charges of combination and conspiracy to increase wages.
Oh, my gosh. Jeez. And I'm reading the fine was $8, which is probably a lot of money back then, right?
Yes. And at this point, I believe that most of the cordwainers, especially these larger, more skilled journeymen, are making roughly about $1 a day. And the other thing about that, the society that they existed or that they participated in, that mutual aid, that mutual benefit society would provide some kind of aid for situations like this as well.
Mm-hmm.
So in many cases, at $8, it was like a token, a symbolic fine of basically saying that you have to admit your guilt to what you've done.
Amazing story. You know what? Let's talk some more about this, because we're going back well over 200 years. And you think about the labor struggle since then that pretty much mirror what happened back in 1805. Let's talk about that. Patrick Grubbs is his name, and he comes to us from Northampton Community College out of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, professor of history there, also associate dean for arts and humanities. And we're talking about the cordwainers' strike of 1805 and the Federal Society of Journeymen Cordwainers. If you're just checking the show right now, cordwainers were shoemakers. And it seems to me they weren't called a union, but this may be, for all practical purposes, probably one of the first unions in America when you think about that. And they actually had a strike prior to that. I'm reading, what was it, in 1799?
Yeah.
When the journeymen struck, and I guess the employers advertised for scab workers. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, and this was actually pretty common, especially in Philadelphia, was they would advertise in newspapers for 20, let's say, cordwainers to produce so many goods at this cost,
you know, yeah,
or at this wage.
So, Patrick, this was part of the first industrial revolution in America. And mm-hmm. then we had the second industrial revolution was what, right after the Civil War, and that was what, coal and steel, when coal and steel made their way into the United States, is that right?
Yep. Yes, that was the rise of the coal and the steel, and the railroads are the major factors, industries in the Second Industrial Revolution.
It seems to me that, and those are the Andrew Carnegies of the world who were very anti-union. It seems like they learned a lot from what happened in the cordwainers strike many years before, because we've seen this throughout labor history. You mentioned in the first segment here, there wasn't any violence or anything like that. But later on, we saw a struggle between workers and management and shutdowns, lockouts. I could go on the Haymarket affair. We have seen various outbursts of conflicts throughout the years. And I'm just wondering, in our discussion today, let's talk about learning some lessons on this. And I'm sure you talk about this at Northampton Community College. How this applies to today? We're still struggling. Unions are suffering through this pandemic. They're trying to organize. What are you telling your kids? What are you telling your students?
It's interesting, actually, that you bring that up, because one of the direct maybe correlations that we see with this cordwainer strike, the 1805, and the Second Industrial Revolution is this was really a concerted attack, if you will, by master artisans on journeyman societies. Like, they didn't have to bring this to trial. They had done so to try to squelch labor. They did so as an attempt to try to hold on to their power and their position in society. This is similar to stuff that, like you said, Carnegie had done at Homestead. We're going to push the issue and force workers. And so they brought this to trial because this had been almost like a 15-year struggle, if you will, between these journeymen and master cordwainers, where finally they had just, the masters had said that we'd had enough, and they bring it to trial. And it's very politicized. Like, the entire movement as a whole is politicized. In the courtroom, it's very clear you have these like prominent Federalist attorneys as prosecutors, and you have a Federalist judge, and these staunch Democratic Republican attorneys for the defense. And the arguments that are being made are similar to things that we hear today about property rights, about how one of the claims were the workers were essentially transients, right? So they had no real say in what was happening in society. And therefore, we have to fall in line with the larger merchants here, because they're the ones that have the real interest in Philadelphia, in society. They mentioned in the trial about how strikes as a whole are evil, right? And that laborers that use these strikes as a form of power are a threat to society, a threat to the social,
right,
the social stability. So a lot of these themes that we see even later are they're playing out here in 1805. And to be honest with you, the end result of this is, yeah, we talked about it. They're found guilty. They're fined $8. But this is really the beginning of the politicalization of labor. Because it's after this moment that we start to see Philadelphia laborers start to drift towards the Democratic Republican Party. Uh-huh. And they start to become more active in politics. And in fact, what's actually pretty interesting from this is that by the 1820s, the journeyman societies in Philadelphia, they're starting to grow. And by the mid-1820s, they actually start to form together. And they were led by a pair of cordwainers, William Highton and William English, who ultimately formed a political organization known as the Working Men's Party of Philadelphia, which was America's first political labor party in American history.
All right, we're going to wrap it up there. Patrick Grubbs. Patrick is a professor of history at Northampton Community College in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Also serves as the Associate Dean for Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences. Patrick, I'm reading that you're completing your dissertation entitled The Rise and Demise of Pennsylvania's Coal and Iron Police. Can you give us a little details on that?
Yeah, to a degree. Actually, these are Pennsylvania didn't have a state police force until 1905. Most states didn't. And there was a lot of, let's say, requests for police, in particular policing, let's say labor incidents of social unrest, so on. And so Pennsylvania passed legislation in the last years of the Civil War that allowed coal and iron companies to own their own private police force. And they had policing powers of the entire state within whatever county that they were commissioned in. Mm-hmm. So basically, these are private industry police that were serving, in many cases, as community police forces that were paid for by the industries and had the power of the state in their pocket.
Sounds like the Pinkerton guards that were used against labor over the years.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me.
To a degree, yes.
Yeah. All right, Patrick, thank you so much for coming to the table today. Patrick Grubbs, again, professor of history at Northampton Community College. You take care. Keep in touch with us.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2011. That was the day the National Labor Relations Board ruled that musicians in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, were employees, not independent contractors. Veteran musicians with the Lancaster Symphony Orchestra attempted to organize a union in 2007. They challenged the dictatorial methods by which musicians were treated. They wanted a contract to spell out the rules for hiring, firing, auditioning, grievance procedures, and more. When it came time to sign union cards, the symphony opposed the election, claiming the musicians were independent contractors. The musicians filed with the Regional Labor Board. After receiving an unfavorable ruling, they turned to the national offices in Washington, D.C. There, the board utilized the common law agency test to determine the musician's status. These questions are to discern how much control workers have over the way they work, whether they are highly skilled, how they're paid, and if they provide their own tools, or in this case, instruments. When more answers tilt toward yes, workers are considered independent contractors. The NLRB determined that though these workers are paid on a 1099 instead of a W-2 form, they are employees because of their working conditions. They concluded that orchestral management exerted a great deal of control. Management determined musicians' dress, their posture and behavior before, during, and after rehearsals and concerts. Management also imposed discipline and firing. Musicians voted to join the Greater Lancaster Federation of Musicians the next spring, but their victory was soon undercut by management's refusal to negotiate a first contract. The musicians filed an unfair labor practice and won. The symphony took the case to a federal appeals court, which settled in the union's favor in the spring of 2016.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
T'was 3 days before Christmas in 1982. At Santa's North Pole workshop, there was lots of work to do. A million toys they had to make for lots of little tykes. When all at once the elves cried out, "We're going out on strike!" Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike. Little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike. The little elfin leader read a list of their demands. He said, "We want brand new outfits and new work gloves for our hands. A little elf gymnasium where we can have some fun. And 3 paid weeks in Florida when Christmas time is done." Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike, and little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike. When Santa heard the elves' demands, they made him really cross. He said, "You elves are forgetting that up here I am the boss. And if you don't get back to work and give up on the strike, I'll get my toys from China and you elves can take a hike." Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike, and little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike. But Mrs. Claus soon heard the news and called her husband's phone. She said, Claus, have you gone crazy? You can't run this place alone. Those boys are just like family, so please don't be a jerk. Negotiate a settlement and get them back to work. So Santa called his lawyers in, and soon the deal was done. The elves ran up and hugged him, and everyone had won. They all worked double shifts until they'd made a million toys, and Santa made deliveries to happy girls and boys. Oh, Debbie almost didn't get her dolly, and Billy almost didn't get his bike, and little girls and boys almost didn't get their toys the year the elves went out on strike. The elves went out on strike.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And while we're not asking for your financial support, we'd really appreciate it if you could take a second to click on the like button and pass the show along. Help build our audience. Our music this week included the National Emblem March by Edwin Eugene Bagley, arranged by Louis Engelke, and performed by the Lancaster Symphony Orchestra Brass Quintet. The Year the Elves Went Out on Strike is by Barry Rabin. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to almost 80 labor radio and podcast shows. Check them out. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The show was edited by Patrick Dixon and produced by me. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.